I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Our conversation today, slavery, from farm workers in India to young girls imprisoned in trailers at American migrant camps. The Bush administration has won plaudits for focusing on the issue, but criticism for conflating paid prostitution with slavery. But first, breaking news today, that General David Petraeus, the four-star general once sidelined by the Pentagon and recently credited with rewriting the military's manual on counterinsurgency and redirecting strategy in Iraq, is nominated for a job promotion. The Bush administration has tapped Petraeus to become the next commander of U.S. Central Command to oversee the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. If confirmed, Petraeus would replace Navy Admiral William Fallon, who stepped down abruptly after Esquire magazine reported he was at odds with President Bush over Iran policy. Petraeus would be replaced in Iraq by Army Lieutenant General Ray Odierno. Dimitri Sevastopoulos is a Pentagon and intelligence correspondent for the Financial Times of London. And Dimitri, if confirmed, when will General Petraeus actually leave Iraq?
Robert Gates, the defense secretary, today said that General Petraeus would leave after he had made a recommendation about whether the U.S. should have further troop reductions after the summer. So the exact date is not clear. It depends on his confirmation and probably comes sometime towards the end of the summer.
Because as we know, Petraeus just testified before Congress that this would be a critical time. He said there'd be a pause in withdrawal of surge troops, but then this period of assessment. You know, was Secretary Gates asked about, you know, this potential break in continuity?
He was asked about that, and his answer was essentially that General Petraeus knows the situation in Iraq, and he's now going to oversee this from a higher altitude, and he's going to be replaced by Lieutenant General Odierno, as you mentioned, who was his number two previously in Iraq. So Odierno and Petraeus have a very close relationship, know each other very well, and so Gates said it shouldn't be a problem.
Well, that's interesting because, as you well know, in Thomas Rick's bestseller, Fiasco, Odierno's unit in Iraq came under criticism. It was said that they had a scorch-and-burn policy. Now he's potentially replacing the man, General Petraeus, who implemented the hearts and minds approach. So is that seen as a disconnect?
I don't think it is now. At one point, before General Odierno went out to serve under General Petraeus the last time, people were concerned about that because General Petraeus's attitude was usually mixed with the people. General Odierno seemed to have more of a kind of a violent approach. But during the course of his time there, he seemed to essentially adopt the approach General Petraeus was taking. And towards the end of the period of them working together, things were apparently going quite well.
Did it seem to you, as you watched this press conference, that with Odierno, who had just come back from Iraq, now turning around and going back, that there was sort of a, you know, there are fewer chess pieces on the chessboard for the military to move around?
I think it's partly that there's fewer chess pieces, people with the right experience at this point in time to move around. I also think it's part that they don't want to upset the apple cart in the last 9 months of the Bush administration. They're putting people back out there in certain jobs who know the region, who know the Iraq war, and they want to keep them in place, and then the next president will come in and as Robert Gates pointed out, can always change these command positions if the next president wants to do that.
Yeah. What else jumped out at you as you listened to today's question and answer?
Well, it was interesting that Secretary Gates said that he had actually intended to nominate Admiral Fallon to stay for an extra year at CENTCOM had he not resigned unexpectedly. And I think that people didn't really realize that. So that was interesting.
What does that say about the, you know, the alleged conflict between Fallon and President Bush on Iran?
I think there was a conflict over Iran. I think there was probably a difference over the perception and the way things were said publicly. I don't think General Petraeus going to CENTCOM really says anything about U.S. policy on Iran changing and becoming more belligerent. I think it's really more about the Iraq war than it is Iran at this point.
Dimitri Sevastopoulos, Pentagon and intelligence correspondent for the Financial Times of London. As General David Petraeus, commander in Iraq, gets a nomination for a promotion to head of U.S. CENTCOM overseeing both Iraq and Afghanistan. Dimitri, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Later today in the program, an uncommitted superdelegate, did Pennsylvania change his mind? But first, our conversation today, it's about slavery. Slavery is not legal anywhere in the world, but there may be more slaves today than at any point in history. The UN estimates begin at 12 million slaves worldwide, and many experts believe the actual number may be more than twice that. And State Department estimates say thousands of slaves are transported into the U.S. every year. John R. Miller was director of the Bush administration's Office to Monitor and Combat Trafficking in Persons from 2004 to 2006. He was elevated to the role of U.S. ambassador at large to bring more attention to the issue of trafficking or slavery. Now, Americans may have images of sweatshops and forced field labor, but Ambassador Miller said that modern-day slavery is a broader picture than that.
You can get into all kinds of legal definitions, but basically what you have here is the complete absence of liberty, in the sense that somebody is forced against their will, and I mean forced, there's the threat of violence, to do work that they don't want to do, generally for just subsistence. So poor working conditions concern many of us. But slavery goes a lot further than poor working conditions. It doesn't mean somebody's in chains, but if you talk about freedom and liberty, this is about as far away from it as you can go.
Well, in some of the examples, there might as well be chains. We hear of children, girls as young as 6, 8, 10, held in tiny trailers at migrant camps in the U.S., being ordered to give sex to men. I mean, describe some of the situations.
Sure, absolutely. You have many kinds of slavery in the world today. You have the sex slavery that you've just referred to, much of it involving children. You described a situation in the United States. I visited Mumbai, India, and you can see in the red light district cages where young women have been held, or girls. So you have sex slavery, you have domestic servitude slavery, you have bonded labor slavery, which generally involves work in mills or farms on the Indian subcontinent. You have child soldier slavery, you have child camel jockey slavery, you have farm and factory slavery. So you have all kinds of slavery in the world. And of course people say, wait a minute, didn't we abolish slavery back in 1866? Yes, that's true. And today, every country in the world has legally abolished slavery. But slavery goes on just as it has gone on since Greek and Roman and biblical times.
Why is it going on? I mean, if it's known, I mean, you mentioned the camel riders. These are young boys who are literally held as slaves to race these camels. It's something that your department got very involved in.
Right.
If everyone knows it's happening and it's illegal, why is it happening?
Why is it happening? I think there's a lot of factors. You have the push and pull factors of poverty, the poverty pushing people into these situations, but the attraction of the better life pulling people that aren't necessarily impoverished. You have attitudes towards gender that have persisted for generations. You have greed. I mean, people are making money on this. And then you have a lot of other factors, complicity, corruption, and particularly low visibility. People have pondered this. Slavery seems so outrageous, Robin. But if you look at a lot of human rights organizations, there's tremendous justifiable concern with religious persecution, political persecution, etc., suppression of speech. The victims of that terrible persecution tend to be more visible and more articulate than the survivors of slavery.
Give me an example of why it's off the radar. I mean, for instance, the child jockeys were perfectly visible, and it was an issue that was addressed, and that became a cultural issue, that which is, I imagine, also a problem. If a culture accepts something, it's hard for you to address it.
Well, that's a good example, because you would have to say if people go to camel races in the United Arab Emirates, you can't say it's invisible.
Right.
Some kinds of slavery are truly invisible. The domestic servant held in a home, that's invisible to the outside world. Even some of the sex slaves in certain brothels may be invisible, or slaves in factories. But your example, of course, you can say, well, camel jockey riding in a race is visible. There's got to be an audience, which there was. I think there you have, as you say, the cultural acceptance that realizing it's there, but not wanting to focus attention on it, not wanting to change the situation. Then the media exposed what was going on. It created a furor. It certainly got my attention. And when attention was focused on this, then the UAE started to do something. And I'm not going to say it's ended, but it's a lot better than it was.
Well, and is that one of the issues? Because Nicholas Kristof writes glowingly of your work, but he writes that some other career diplomats who have to work with countries view your office with a little bit of suspicion because they're like, look, we are trying to have relations. We've got other issues that we have to deal with. Don't upset our apple cart, as he writes, muck up relations on a peripheral issue.
Yeah, sure. I would have to say that enters into it. From my point of view, the point of view of the office that I headed, if you're dealing with another government, particularly a friendly government, as a friend, you have an obligation to raise the issue. And I think sometimes we're a little too sensitive about this. Having said that, no country or government in the world does more about raising this issue than the United States.
Well, the Bush administration has been given a lot of credit, again, by Nicholas Kristof, who has also walked the walk on this issue himself. But what about, you know, the critics who say that, in fact, it's been blown way out of proportion, that the strange bedfellows of the conservative Bush administration and feminist groups have focused more on sex workers, first of all, than on other enslaved laborers, and there are far more of the other kind of enslaved laborers, and further have conflated prostitution with forced slavery and kind of muddied the waters and confused the issue that you know, a high-priced call girl, yep, who visits with Elliot Spitzer, yep, who comes and goes as, yep, she pleases, is not the same as that little girl who's held in a trailer at a migrant camp.
Those are two very good questions. Let me answer them in order. The first was, is there too much emphasis on sex slavery as opposed to forced labor? Well, if you read the State Department's reports, and I happen to have brought the last one, there's a lot of emphasis on forced labor. But one should not apologize for the emphasis on sex slavery. Yes, there are huge numbers of forced laborers on the Indian subcontinent. But if you look at trafficking across international borders, the sex slave trade is by far the biggest. You mentioned the Elliot Spitzer case. Of course, the women that are getting thousands of dollars from these wealthy public officials or businessmen or whatever, there's a good chance they're not slaves at all. But the Christians of Elliot Spitzer notoriety are the exception. The vast majority have suffered abuse, harassment, assault, rape, want to escape.
That's John Miller, former U.S. ambassador on human trafficking from 2004 until 2006. You heard what he just said, but still, when we come back, did he quit his job, as some have said, because moralists in the White House were focusing more on paid prostitutes than caged workers? We'll have more with him later. Calvin Trillin on a sticky question in Calcutta. Those hand-pulled rickshaws, rickshaw pullers love their jobs, but some in Calcutta feel it looks too much like, well, forced labor. We'll be back in a minute, here and now. We're back with more of our conversation on modern-day slavery with John Miller. Miller won praise from a wide range of people for his leadership of the Bush administration's efforts to combat trafficking in slaves. He was the U.S. ambassador in that office. But the administration also got some criticism for their strong focus on sex slavery, which accounts for only a small number of slaves in the world. Miller defends the administration's record. He points out that sex slavery is the largest category of slavery in advanced nations and the biggest factor in the trafficking of people across international borders. But there have been reports that Ambassador Miller left his post because of his frustration. So we asked him, any truth to that?
Absolutely not true. I believe there's a direct link between sex slavery and prostitution. I certainly had frustrations in my post. Listen, when you're trying to abolish slavery worldwide, I can tell you, even though the United States may have done as much or more than any other government, there's a heck of a lot more we could be doing. Mm-hmm. You're darn right it's frustrating when you're in the State Department. I won't deny frustration. along with satisfaction. There was plenty of frustration, but not because of emphasis on sex slavery. I don't like this dividing up. If people want more emphasis on labor slavery, let's have more emphasis on labor slavery. Let's fight it. But it's not like we can say, well, some slavery is better or some slavery is worse. All slavery is terrible.
What should we do when you say not enough is being done? What should be done?
I think in general, we should be even more willing to stand up for those who are the victims and the survivors, even if we, in the short term, offend allies or friends.
And who are those allies?
Well, I'll give you some examples. Western Europe. People may think, oh, Western Europe, democracies, they don't have slavery. Of course they have slavery going on.
Where?
Listen, in Germany, you have sex slavery. They have some wonderful programs, but most of the traffickers don't go to jail. They get put out on probation or suspension. In the Netherlands, they have a legalized sex trade. They thought that was the way to handle it. They started attracting victims from all over the world. Now they're having second thoughts. One-third of the brothels in Amsterdam's red light district have been shut down because they found that they were trafficking victims and there were links to organized crime. There is slavery in every democracy of the world. Japan. I had big battles in Japan. Japan started doing something about this, though. India, the world's largest democracy. Now there, you talk about forced labor slavery. They have huge sex slavery, but where they're doing the least and where they need to do more is on forced labor slavery, bonded labor slavery.
What are they making? What are the industries that they're slaves in?
Bricks, textiles, very, very basic commodities. I was out in the fields of India near Chennai, near a rice mill. The wonderful thing is that three generations of victims had been freed. That was the wonderful thing. And for this, we need to give the provincial government and groups like International Justice Mission credit. However, this is why so much more needs to be done. Well, where were you held slave? Where were you beaten? Where were you confined? Where did you suffer sexual abuse? Where did you work 14 hours a day? Oh, Ambassador, just right over there, a mile away, is the rice mill. And I said, is it still operating? Oh, yes. Was there any punishment of the owner? No.
How about here in the U.S.? Just one last question, because a few years ago, the New York Times published that Sunday Magazine cover story on the sex slave trade in the U.S., and then there was a lot of controversy. A series of critics pointed out that money and effort was spent to find the slaves, especially sex slaves in the U.S., but not that many had been found. So, again, there was this criticism that the issue was blown up here in the U.S. But even so, there's legislation that's pending. I think it's reenactment of legislation. It was passed by the House. It's in the Senate right now. And critics of that legislation, Benjamin Skinner is one of them. He's written a book on the slave trade. And he says that even when the U.S. is addressing this issue, they're again conflating both the Elliot Spitzer call girl and a child who's held as a slave, that it paints both with the same brush. So even when there is legislation, it's said to just be more rhetoric.
Yeah, sure. Well, first of all, Benjamin Skinner has written an outstanding book on slavery around the world, A Crime So Monstrous. And he even said a few good things about me in the book. So it is with great reluctance that I disagree with Benjamin Skinner. But or at least what you say is his position. But I think this proposed legislation is very good. It strengthens some of the forced labor provisions in the law. And the part on sex, which I think is good, is it puts the focus for the first time on the pimps. It recognizes that in the United States, where sex slavery is the largest discrete category of slavery, the slave masters are by and large the pimps. And whether they're holding migrants from Korea or African American young girls, they are the ones that are making $600,000 a year. They are the ones that are holding pimp balls. And if you're going to deal with this issue, you can't just pretend it's theoretical. You have to go after these pimps and put them in jail. And this is where there's a tremendous coalition and alliance forming involving feminist groups, faith-based groups, civil rights groups, African-American groups, Hispanic groups, saying, yes, this is the problem in our community. We can no longer just look the other way. And I think this will help to reduce slavery in the United States.
That's Ambassador John Miller. He was the director of the Bush administration's Office to Monitor and Combat Trafficking in Persons from 2004 to 2006. Our table here in the studio felt his passion. Tomorrow on Here and Now, do you need a special forces team, a detachment of Chilean infantrymen? We'll look into Blackwater's expanding global private army. That's tomorrow. Still ahead, one analyst says that tortured tango that Democrats are doing is a good thing for the party. We'll hear him out. Back after the news, Here and Now. Indiana is the new Pennsylvania, the next crucial tiebreaker in the hard-fought battle for the Democratic presidential nomination. Both Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton are campaigning in Indiana today, following Clinton's 10-point stay in the game, but short of a knockout win over Obama in Pennsylvania yesterday. Gerald Seib, executive Washington editor of the Wall Street Journal and weekly Capital Journal columnist for the newspaper, says this is a good thing. I'm paraphrasing, but Jerry, you write, you know, it's not what Democrats want to hear, but basically, what doesn't kill these candidates is making them stronger?
Well, that's at least a possibility here. You know, I think there is clearly some damage to the party because of bruised feelings. But what I'm saying is that it is possible that going through this process, which isn't fun necessarily, maybe produces a tougher, stronger, and better vetted general election candidate when it's over. That maybe from the Democrats' point of view, it's not a bad thing to have the criticisms aired now in an intra-party fight rather than wait until October when they can be attacked on some of these points by the Republicans in a way that will become harder for them to refute and will come much closer to the actual election.
Let me pick a couple that you mentioned. If Senator Clinton is going to have to explain the awkward reality that she now wants to renegotiate the very NAFTA agreement that her husband championed, better to practice that explanation now?
Exactly. I mean, you know, there's no doubt that John McCain, who is a free trade candidate, is going to go after Hillary Clinton if she's the nominee on exactly this point. How can you have been a champion of the free trade agreement in North America in the 90s and then in the new millennium decide that it has been a bad thing for the economy and has to be renegotiated? That is the criticism that she's hearing now. She's working out an explanation of that, which is a little tricky, and it's probably better that she figure out how she explains that to voters when she's doing it to Democrats first rather than to the general public.
It would seem to be even better for Barack Obama, who has, you know, as Clinton has said, a lot of her baggage has been rummaged through.
Mm-hmm.
He's fresher. His hasn't. So in particular, maybe this campaign trail might get him in better shape.
Well, I think the point is probably more apt for him than her. I mean, the people are still finding out things about Barack Obama, and probably better to find out some of those things now than in the fall, because you know, a calm explanation is more possible over months rather than over weeks or even days, and that's the way things happen in the fall when you get closer to the general election.
It's not just about getting them ready for the general election; it's about getting them ready for the White House, because you know the White House, someone said to you, is like drinking water from a fire hose full blast. So practice now.
Yeah, exactly. And there are a few things that can ready you for that, but a campaign is a pretty good way of looking at it.
But what about the money? You know, the money spent, the nerves frayed, the sense that we're all caught in that, you know, that awful movie, Jane Fonda was in it, They Shoot Horses, Don't They? It was about a dance marathon in the Depression era. You know, that everybody's just sort of hanging off each other doing this terrible waltz.
Yeah, look, there's no doubt there are definite and considerable downsides for the party as well. I think money is one, although there seems to be a lot of money out there. I think the bigger one is that, in a way, the attacks that Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama are leveling at each other now are in a way validating what the Republicans will want to say and do in attack ads in the fall. In other words, the Republicans can't be accused of overreaching or hitting below the belt, use the metaphor that you want. In the fall, they can simply point back to what's happening right now and say, look, the Democrats started this, we didn't.
Well,
and I think that is a problem.
Well, in fact, let's look at the impact of the negative campaigning. The exit polls from Pennsylvania show the voters didn't like it. The New York Times editorial page, which endorsed Clinton, the New York senator, said she's largely at fault for the negative campaigning and she should call off the dogs. But voters going to the polls in Pennsylvania didn't seem to switch the candidates, and they turned out in numbers. So in some way, maybe, you know, what we're seeing as the negative campaigning really doesn't have much to do with the final vote.
It's one of the classic questions about American politics. Everybody says they don't like negative campaigning. The reality suggests to you, if you look at it over time, that it actually works in many cases. And voters, even voters who say they don't like it, tend to pay attention to it. I think it is a potential problem for Hillary Clinton, though, because her negative ratings are higher with voters generally than are Barack Obama's. If she's seen as the instigator of too much negativity, that may have the effect of lowering people's opinion of her faster than they may lower their opinion of Barack Obama.
Well, and some say if Barack Obama does it, he's the one who pledged to take the high road. It makes him look more coarsened. On the other hand, weak if he doesn't fight back.
Right.
Well, let's just take a look at what you think's happened here and where we go from here. You wrote that, forget soccer moms, this election is about football dads. Hillary Clinton did win in the vote of white men in Pennsylvania. But is that, you know, football dad thing true going on? I mean, North Carolina, Oregon, is that still the theory?
It's true in a lot of states. It's basically football dads is a metaphor for working class white males. And I think it's a key constituency and one that's in flux this year. You know, working class Democrats tended to move in some numbers toward the Republicans, starting with the Reagan era, of course. They have moved back toward the Democrats in recent years, particularly in 2006. But women have moved back more than men have in the sense that the Republicans still have a hold on working-class white males. But that audience is available because of economic anxiety, at least that's the theory. Hillary Clinton has done relatively better amongst those people than Barack Obama has. But you have to look back at a primary such as the one in Wisconsin, where he did quite well among working-class white males. So I think it's an open question, but it's an interesting and up-for-grabs demographic this year.
Well, Jerry Seib, looking at yesterday's results, is there a set of statistics that jumps out at you that surprised you or you think is important going ahead?
I think one number that kind of jumps out at you is the Catholic vote in Pennsylvania, which went very heavily toward Hillary Clinton. White Catholic vote tends to be sort of a metaphor for ethnic and working class. It sort of points to a perhaps enduring weakness for Barack Obama. Not enough to get in the way, but a potential general election problem for him if he's the nominee.
Well, then what about the math? I mean, can Clinton find the, 400,000 or so votes she needs to catch up with Obama, or the electoral votes she needs? Is it still going to come down to the currently uncommitted superdelegates?
It's very hard to see a scenario in which it doesn't come down to the superdelegates at this point. I mean, you look at the states that are ahead, and it's hard to construct a mathematical scenario in which Hillary Clinton gets either enough popular votes or enough pledged delegates to overtake Barack Obama. So it does look as if Hillary Clinton is going to stay in. It does look as if we run out the entire string of primaries, which takes us through the first week of June. And then the question that is on the table is, what about the superdelegates? It's hard to see right now of how this plays out in any other way.
Well, and one last factor, we mentioned money, and you write that Barack Obama seems to have tapped into an internet-fed vein of small Democratic donors nobody knew even existed before. What is that vein?
You know, I think this is one of the questions that's going to be studied a lot when this year is over. How did this money get tapped? Why wasn't it there before? Was it the internet, which made it easier for people to do this? Was it the appeal of Barack Obama? Was it a sense that people had that they wanted to somehow take the political system back themselves that brought out all these small donors? I'm not sure I know, and I think people are going to be dissecting it for a while.
That's Gerald Seib, executive Washington editor and columnist for The Wall Street Journal. A quick note, in this race for those superdelegates, Oklahoma's governor today endorsed Barack Obama. That gives Obama 3 of the 10 superdelegates in that state. Clinton has 1. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, staying with superdelegates on the morning TV shows, Hillary Clinton said they should reconsider her in light of her Pennsylvania win. Senator Obama staffer was seen leaving Pennsylvania wearing a Stop the Drama, Vote Obama T-shirt. On the line, an uncommitted superdelegate. He's a cattle rancher and Montana State Democratic chair in Montana, Dennis McDonald. Dennis, just between you and me, who are you voting for?
Well, I tell you what, Robin, first of all, thanks for having me on. It's a beautiful day here in Montana. Though I'm pleased that you're asking me that question, I'm not going to answer it.
Somehow I knew. What kind of pressure are you getting? I mean, you know, we hear about, have you gotten a phone call from Chelsea Clinton?
Better than that. Well, I shouldn't say better than that, but just as good. I had an opportunity to travel with former President Bill Clinton a couple of weeks ago, who publicly offered to wash my windshield and shine my boots. And though they needed shining, it wasn't successful in getting me to commit.
What has the Obama campaign done?
I've heard from many members of the Obama campaign, including Barack himself. But again, I've staunchly maintained my independence and probably not going to commit until after we hear from Montana voters on June 3rd.
Now, why is that? Do you need to vote with the voters in Montana? Would you vote independent from them?
Possibly, but out of respect for both of these terrific candidates and this terrific race, which, by the way, is generating huge interest here in Montana, bringing people into the process that often don't participate, we see it as very positive.
But Montanans might read something into your response, because you said you might possibly vote differently than Montanans do. And, you know, the speculation is that Barack Obama is expected to win the primary there on June 3rd.
Well, I wouldn't read anything into that. As this campaign has unfolded, there's been a number of surprises. And so I would want to listen and decide at that time based on all the circumstances.
What did you hear out of Pennsylvania that interested you?
First of all, I have to congratulate Senator Clinton. But we come out of Pennsylvania basically with the status quo. As everyone's saying this morning, this race is going on and ultimately coming right here to Montana. And as you know, we're usually ignored.
Well, as we've been hearing, Senator Clinton did well with white rural voters in Pennsylvania. Barack Obama did not. Your state, of course, Montana, has a lot of white rural voters. But we also just heard that Barack Obama did well with those voters in Wisconsin. So are you bothering to read the tea leaves?
I do read the tea leaves on occasion, and keeping my ear to the ground here, I don't see the demographics playing exactly the way they have did in Pennsylvania. I hear a lot of support among farmers and ranchers, predominantly white folks that are supporting Barack. So I don't know. It'll be interesting how this plays out.
How are you feeling overall about the fact that it's going to be superdelegates like you, party officials, who, it seems, are going to end up deciding this?
Well, frankly, that may be the only disappointing factor. It would be nice to have the popular vote making that final decision. But if that's the hand we're dealt, we'll deal with it.
Well, let's just stop you there for a second, because if Barack Obama maintains the popular vote going into the convention in Denver, you've just said you think that the popular vote, you know, should decide it. Well, you know, will you rebel against it being decided by superdelegate votes, or are you saying that you feel you should go with the popular vote?
You're pretty good, Robin, but again, I'm not going to answer you directly, and that's normally not my nature. I think this is a healthy debate. I think it's going to help build the Democratic Party here in Montana, and it's just an exciting time.
Dennis McDonald, cattle rancher and state Democratic Party chair in Montana. Dennis, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Robin.
We'll be back in a minute with Calvin Trillin, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
To Westerners, the conveyance most identified with Kolkata is not its modern subway, a facility whose spacious stations have art on the walls and cricket matches on television monitors, but the hand-pulled rickshaw. Stories and films celebrate a primitive-looking cart with high wooden wheels, pulled by someone who looks close to needing the succor of Mother Teresa. For years, the government has been talking about eliminating hand-pulled rickshaws on what it calls humanitarian grounds, principally on the ground that, as the mayor of Kolkata has often said, it is offensive to see one man sweating and straining to pull another man. But these days, politicians also lament the impact of 6,000 hand-pulled rickshaws on a modern city's traffic, and particularly on its image.
The familiar voice of Calvin Trillin, reading from his essay on the rickshaw in Calcutta in this month's National Geographic magazine. You can read the essay and see the wonderful photos taken by Amy Vitale at our website, here-now.org, as Calvin Trillin joins us from his home in New York. Welcome back to Here and Now.
Thanks very much.
Your article is called The Last Days of the Rickshaw. As you said, Westerners identify Calcutta. Now, Calcutta, it's now called Kolkata?
Yeah, although nobody I spoke to there in English says Kolkata.
Either way, it's identified with the rickshaw to Westerners. But what do people who live there identify the rickshaw with?
People who live in Calcutta think of it as a way partly to haul things around the town, particularly in the narrow alleyways, and also often use it as a sort of ambulance service. Many families contract with a rickshaw wala to take their children to school. So the same guy comes every day. He becomes sort of a family retainer.
You say rickshaw wala. The walas are the people who pull the rickshaws. Tell us more about them.
Almost none of them are from Calcutta. They're from Bihar, which is a terribly poor place. And traditionally, people have come from Bihar to Calcutta to be rickshaw drivers. And they live there either in something called a dera, which is sort of a dormitory, or on the street sometime, or some of them sleep in their rickshaws.
When you say the dera is sort of a dormitory, yeah, if a dormitory were in like a garage.
I say in the piece that it costs about $1.50 a month for them, which sounds like a bargain until you see the dera.
You describe in your Calvin Trillin deadpan way what it's like for a human to get around in Calcutta. You know, just across the streets, you sort of like just try to attach yourself to as many people as possible.
My strategy was to attach myself to more people than I thought a taxi driver was willing to mow down.
Right.
And in the small alleys and lanes, people go at tremendous speeds in small mini trucks. And then occasionally you hear this tinkle of the bell. The rickshaw wallas always have a little bell that they have on one finger that they tinkle. And I say in the piece that an American who's seen too many Hallmark specials might glance back expecting to see horses pulling grandma and everybody else through the woods, but in fact it's a rickshaw.
And sort of this lovely little touch, but behind it, you know, is just, well, what? I mean, is it painful for them? I may be imposing my own thoughts on it, but they're barefooted.
When they say humanitarian grounds is why they want to end it, they really mean sort of symbolic humanitarian grounds. There are some people who don't like the idea of being judged as a primitive city because it has this rickshaw. Mother Teresa, as you might know, caused a lot of trouble in Calcutta. I hate to blame everything on her, but Calcutta did really have its difficulties, but Mother Teresa's presence sort of linked it in the public mind in the West with squalor. And then there are also people who are offended by the thought of somebody pulling another person as if the puller were an animal and won't go in a rickshaw. Ironically, some of those people are not for getting rid of the rickshaws. They're not sure the moral part of the argument is depriving these people of making a living.
Well, and then there's another element. There's sort of a whiff of, well, more than a whiff, of colonialism.
Although I think I expected when I went to Calcutta to see the rickshaws sort of like the horse and buggies in Central Park or something, pulling tourists around. I actually saw almost no tourists in Calcutta. They're really for, as somebody put it, not the poor, but people who are sort of notch above the poor. They're not a kind of a touristy, gimmicky thing. They're transportation. Someone said when it rains, even the governor takes a rickshaw.
Well, Calvin Trillin, what else do you think the rickshaws tell us about Calcutta? Again, you said you didn't see that many tourists there, and yet you've said that you think it's one of the, you know, great cities. Put us in some sort of context with, by way of, you know, the rickshaws.
Calcutta is a place that was the original headquarters of the Raj, of the British rulers of India. And culturally and intellectually is sort of the most vibrant city of India and always has been. West Bengal, the state it's in, has been run by the communists for 30 years. They, for much of that time, concentrated on the rural poor. Now they're very interested in investment. They might talk about the joys of communism, but they meet the California Investment Group. And so they don't want to be thought of as a place that has this relatively primitive device to pull people around. Ironically, I live in Canada in the summer, and somebody told me that in Toronto there are hand-pulled rickshaws pulled by college football players. They do it to keep in shape.
Well, in fact, there's a company right here in Cambridge, Massachusetts, that's doing the same thing. It's a delivery service. They use bike rickshaws. They call them cargo trikes, and they get around the city faster than a truck can without the pollution. So that's interesting that in one place they're thinking of banning the rickshaw, and another they're taking it up as an answer to global warming.
Yes, that's true.
Well, what do you think will ultimately happen in Calcutta? Do you think those who want to clean up the city will ban rickshaws, or do you think the thinking that they're a symbol of the city and a livelihood for people and shouldn't go will prevail?
The piece ends when I talk about a report that somebody in the city gave me about how to find alternate jobs for these rickshaw wallahs, and there were five or six options laid out, and I noticed that the report was a year old, and I said, which option has been chosen? And the man I was talking to said, that hasn't been decided. And I said, when will it be decided? And he said, that hasn't been decided. So I think it's going to take a long time.
That's Calvin Trillin. His story, Last Days of the Rickshaw, maybe, I add the maybe, appears in the April issue of National Geographic. You can read it and see the pictures taken by Amy Vitale at our website, here-now.org. I'm looking at one, a rickshaw carrying over 100 live chickens.
They tie them together upside down and just drape them over the two poles that you use to pull it, over the axle, over the back of it. I mean, it's amazing how many upside down chickens they can get on there.
To the chickens' dismay.
Yeah, chickens don't sound happy.
No. Calvin, thank you so much. And by the way, we just want to ask one last thing, because last time we spoke, it was to talk about Alice, which is also the name of your book, about your late beloved wife and muse. And you told us then that you thought that your writing had suffered since she died in 2001. How are you feeling today?
Well, I don't know if it's suffer. I mean, I people said, how, you know, what's the result of not having her to read the pieces and respond to them? And I said, well, the pieces aren't as good, but I think it's sort of a flip answer. I guess I'm writing now, and I started writing more serious reporting pieces, and then after a while I could even write pieces that were meant to be funny. So I think I'm sort of back writing.
Yeah. Well, we think we're sort of glad. Thank you so much.
Thank you.